It's Tuesday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, chemical weapons are being used in the fierce battle for Aleppo.
That is not permitted, to use your official position to influence an election.
Did the FBI director try to influence the U.S. presidential election? One Republican says yes. Many voters have ignored the campaign rhetoric and are voting early. Also ahead, investors watch segments of the market affected by the vote. And new news about a late pop icon. It's all on today's International Edition. Rebel forces have been pressing their attacks on the government-controlled western part of the embattled Syrian city of Aleppo with shelling, rocket fire, and suicide bombings. Both sides have accused the other of employing chemical weapons. Dozens of civilians, including children, have reportedly been killed since the assault was launched from the rebel-held eastern sector on Friday. UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura said that he is appalled and shocked by the indiscriminate use of rockets on civilian suburbs of western Aleppo. The city has been decimated by some of the heaviest fighting of the Syrian civil war as the opposition seeks to break a six-week government assault on the rebel-held sector backed by Syrian and Russian airstrikes. Analyst Alan Payend of Ohio State University tells VOA's Victor Beatty a rebel assault was inevitable, given the growing desperation of the civilians under their control.
They were desperate in some ways. They thought that probably they are losing support from the other Arab neighbors and their support from the international community. The international community is not paying any attention. So they wanted to make this effort so the people that who are supporting the regime, their argument is this is a desperate situation that they are doing. They wanted it's a suicidal attack. But when you are fighting against a government which is supported by Russia and Iran, and really very little is left for the opposition. So they are using all these desperate situations. There is no question about that, with the very heavy casualties on the sides of the rebels.
Well, they still seem to be able to funnel fighters and weapons into the rebel-held sector.
Yeah, they do. The important thing is that is the support of the 250,000 people. So the 250,000 people are fed up with the regime. So the strength of the opposition is that the majority of the Syrian population who are Sunnis, they do not like the regime. The heavy-handed regime with the help of Iran and with the help of Russia. So they can do these things because there is a popular support of these 250,000 people. No one can really be sure that how many, but the majority of them are supportive of the opposition to the government. So that's the strength. It's the same situation in many other countries. When the regime is very unpopular, people are mostly taking side of the rebel groups. This happened in Mosul too, because Mosul in Iraq was a Sunni-majority city. And all of the Shia-dominated government of Iraq and the Shia militias were suppressing these Sunnis. And finally, the Sunni population of Mosul welcomed the Islamic State. So the same sort of thing is happening in a smaller scale in Aleppo and other cities. So it's true that it's a small group, the opposition is smaller, weaker, but there is a popular support for that group among the populace.
Ohio State's Alan Payend said with the Bashar al-Assad regime deeply unpopular among the population and the international community incapable of ending the fighting, the violence seems to have no end. The story continues on our website at voanews.com, and be sure to follow more stories through our social media output. That is at @VOA_IE on Twitter and also on our Facebook page at VOA Now. Speaking of what's buzzing online, International Edition's Jia Billy joins me right here in the studio with today's trending stories. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. That's a mouthful.
Well, today is Halloween here in the United States still. And if you had your Halloween already, we hope it was a good one. What are people saying about it online?
So the big debate on social media is what the worst Halloween candy is. And Jim, you know, we just had the same discussion by our food table. And I have to say, the internet agrees with me.
Mm.
Many Twitter users wrote that candy corn is their least favorite. In fact, the U.S. Department of Education created a poll on Twitter It asked what the worst Halloween candy is and gave us two options. First, candy corn. Second, it's always candy corn.
Well, I remember when British chef Gordon Ramsay, who is very outspoken, said that candy corn is, in his words, earwax formed in the shape of a rotten tooth. Now, that is scary. But candy corn can't be everyone's least favorite.
That's right. So apart from candy corn, many Twitter users also expressed their discontent with circus peanuts. One woman tweeted, "I love my kids so much that they have no idea what circus peanuts taste like. They are peanut-shaped marshmallow candies." I mean, they are just basically marshmallows, right?
Well, you get those at every holiday. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they're little chicks at Easter, and it's just marshmallow stuff.
Shaped for the occasion.
There you go. Well, moving on, what else is trending?
So this one is also Halloween-themed. Judging by mentions on social media, 11 is definitely the most popular costume among millennials. 11 is a female character in American sci-fi horror series Stranger Things, and she's a young girl with psychokinetic abilities. Because the story is set in the 80s, the costume requires knee-high socks, sneakers, and frozen breakfast Eggo waffles. Some people are tweeting photos of the empty shelves where Eggo waffles got sold out, reflecting the popularity of the 11 character.
All right. Very interesting. Anything else?
That's all from me, Jim.
All right. Thanks for that wrap-up, G. And you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our individual accounts are at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, South Korean political crisis could affect hardline North Korea policy. Afghan forces suffered 15,000 casualties in first 8 months of 2016. Ex-jihadists try to curb Islamic State appeal in Indonesia. Japan-Philippines deals signal shift to multi-country foreign policy. Philippines says China is still guarding a shoal, but the Filipinos are back. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at our voanews.com website and via our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Democrats and one prominent Republican are accusing FBI Director James Comey of wielding his authority for political purposes after Friday's announcement that the FBI is reviewing a new batch of emails that could shed light on Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton's handling of sensitive information while she was Secretary of State. In a letter to the FBI, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid accused Comey of tarring Secretary Clinton with thin innuendo and demonstrating what appears to be a clear intent to aid one political party over another. Also, a prominent Republican formally accused the FBI director of misconduct. Richard Painter, who served as the White House's chief ethics lawyer under President George W. Bush and who now teaches law at the University of Minnesota, has filed complaints with the Office of Special Counsel, which investigates Hatch Act violations, and with the Office on Government Ethics. The FBI has not responded to Painter's allegations and confirmed without comment that it received Senator Reid's letter. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman spoke with Painter about the Hatch Act, what it is, and how he sees the FBI director's actions violating the act.
The Hatch Act prohibits executive branch officials from using their official position to influence an election. That is not permitted, to use your official position to influence an election. And Director Comey allowed the FBI to be manipulated by the members of the House Oversight Committee into releasing this information shortly before the election so they could just post it on the Internet. And furthermore, the letter is misleading because it does not appear that the FBI has any new information about Secretary Clinton. They didn't even have a search warrant to search the computer at the time they sent the letter. The letter is misleading.
What would America lack if it did not have the Hatch Act? I mean, why is this important for our democracy?
Well, the ordinary Hatch Act violation is somebody going and using their official title to give a political speech trying to use government money to announce pork barrel projects right before an election with a congressman standing right there and so forth. I mean, that's the run-of-the-mill Hatch Act violation. This is an extraordinary violation, I think, particularly serious, because we're talking about trying to use the FBI to go after political opponents of the congressmen who are in the majority of the committee. And that's unacceptable. I'm a Republican. I might see more Republicans elected, but they're not going to be if they behave this way. And the FBI should never have allowed itself to be used this way.
Does the Hatch Act mean that whoever is violating it has to be doing so with clear intent to do so? Obviously, we can't be in James Comey's mind, and I'm sure that from his perspective, he thought that he was acting responsibly and within his professional duties.
Well, there are two ways you can violate the Hatch Act. One is if you yourself intend to influence a partisan election with your official actions. And there's some evidence that he might have some animosity toward Hillary Clinton, given the statements he made 2 months ago and 3 months ago and at the conclusion of that investigation and the inaccurate wording of this letter. The second way you violate the Hatch Act is to act under pressure from other people who clearly do want you to do something that's going to influence an election. And whether you want to do it or not, you cave into that pressure. And here it's an investigation that had already been closed with respect to Secretary Clinton's email. And it was an entirely different investigation having nothing to do with Secretary Clinton. So it's completely unjustified action that really can only be used for a political purpose. And that's a violation of the Hatch Act.
Richard Painter, former White House chief ethics lawyer under President George W. Bush. The divisive campaign rhetoric, though, is being ignored by voters who are casting early ballots, many of them doing it in about 37 U.S. states right now. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports on voters in the key battleground state of North Carolina.
North Carolina voter Scott Herrick was eager to cast his ballot in this year's presidential contest. He says environmental issues drove his decision.
I do believe that climate change is a factor in why I'm voting today, and I believe that Hillary Clinton has kind of the same philosophy on this that I do. I do not believe that we really had a traditional election between a Republican and a Democrat this year. I think we had an election between a Democrat and kind of a totalitarian.
We need change. We are about change.
Republican Lewis Hutchinson voted for Donald Trump. He's concerned about the loss of American manufacturing jobs and wants tougher immigration measures.
I like Trump's idea about closing the borders to the Muslims and making it, you know, now I'm not saying to keep the Muslims out. I'm saying get it where they come in legally.
Voter Sylvia Richardson immigrated to the United States from Africa. She doesn't agree with Trump's immigration policy.
Trump is talking is like he's going to take everybody away from, you know, from United States. No, everybody, most of the people here, they are immigrants. So, of course, there are bad people that he can, you know, take away from. But among those people, there are good people, too.
College student Maddie Hain was a first-time voter. She says women's rights and education are key issues for her.
The children really shape what happens in the future. If they don't have a strong foundation, it's really hard for them to grow.
Giba McDaniel also views education as a big issue. She wants her son Malik to see democracy at work.
I have three children, and him being 14 years old, I wanted him to see simply that you just need to vote.
Malik can't vote until he's 18, but his mother hopes he understands it's his right to participate in the democratic process. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Greensboro, North Carolina.
The upcoming election has investors looking at several segments of the financial market. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York as healthcare is one of the big issues of concern.
Yep, there was a lot of M&A activity in October. In fact, it was a record-breaking month in some instances. But there was one deal I want to focus on today. It's called Team Health. It's a U.S. hospital staffing provider, and they agreed to be bought by private equity firm Blackstone in a deal valued at about $6.1 billion. The deal is expected to close in the first quarter of 2017, and that would allow Team Health to cope with pricing pressure as a private company amid a wave of consolidation within the sector. The U.S. physician services industry has been rapidly consolidating to counter rising administrative costs due to Obamacare and the desire to offer a broader array of services to hospitals. So I think even after this election, we're going to continue to see consolidation in the healthcare space, and cost is going to also continue to be a motivating factor throughout the election and subsequent elections. Quite frankly, costs are on the forefront of not only companies' minds, but consumer minds. In fact, November is when we're going to see a big increase in insurance premiums, and I think this is going to be an issue that's not going to go away.
Obamacare has been much talked about. Costs are rising, and health care is going to be a concern for whichever administration takes over. And, of course, markets are watching the upcoming election.
Right. We have the Federal Reserve meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday. It's not expected that we'll get an interest rate hike. We also have the unemployment report on Friday. Now, this will be the last set of employment data prior to the December interest rate hike meeting, and that's going to be a big catalyst for the Fed. So I think it's not this meeting on Wednesday that's going to have as much of an impact, but certainly the employment data on Friday, which will give more of a clue into what they're going to do in December. We also have a heavy week of earnings, including Facebook, Starbucks, and Time Warner. And then, you know, we're in the home stretch of the election. We're just about 8 days away. Most traders and analysts I speak with think that the reaction will be short-term, volatile in nature, and markets, for the most part, will continue doing business as usual. We saw on last Friday when the FBI reopened its investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, the market dipped about 0.5% on the S&P 500 and recovered quite nicely to close out the day. And I think that's really going to be what the larger reaction is when we get the results next week.
Despite the election on for at least another term, our own Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Hard to believe, 6 months have already passed since the death of Prince, but there's a lot of new news. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us in the studio with the latest.
First of all, the investigation into Prince's death will remain sealed until next year, so we're really not going to learn any more specifics. He passed away from an overdose of the drug fentanyl, and police continue to investigate the circumstances surrounding that death. On October 21st, a Minnesota judge extended authorities' search warrant until commencement of criminal proceedings. So that something is still in the works there.
The investigation into his death is quite different from what we saw in Michael Jackson's case, where we knew who the doctor was right away, and there were all sorts of allegations and media reports swirling about him almost immediately.
Well, there were some initial allegations aimed at Prince's physicians, but those seem to have gone away or are simply not being reported on right now. It's very much still under investigation, and they're keeping a tight lid on things. The judge also sealed all documents accompanying that investigation. Now, the website The Wrap says that those documents will remain sealed until next April, which would be the one-year anniversary of Prince's passing.
No!
In other developments, his attorney, L. Londell McMillan, is denying reports that Jay-Z offered $40 million to buy the rights to Prince's unreleased music. He says those music rights are not up for sale, and those responsible are not in discussions with anyone. I don't know if I believe that.
Quite in a massive state sitting there in Minnesota, in both terms of money and also the wealth of music. Apparently, he was just recording constantly.
He was recording constantly. And also, as far as his estate, his physical estate goes, his compound, Paisley Park, there was talk of turning it into a museum. Now, it's in a semi-rural area. It's not very well served by roads. And the county commissioners are a little reluctant to go ahead with that because they worry about Graceland-style crowds. He has so much unreleased music there. And Billboard recently reported that the three U.S. major labels, Sony, Universal, and Warner, are definitely in talks for the rights. They would love to get their hands on this music. And finally, there's the matter of Prince's estate. People claiming to be relatives of Prince continue to emerge from the woodwork. This Wednesday, a judge ruled that two women claiming to be his niece and grandniece are not heirs, so they will not get anything. Prince died without a will, and this complicates things to an incredible degree. A lot of things going on with Prince still.
A lot of news about the purple one and a man who sometimes wears purple while he does his top 20 countdown, Ray McDonald. You can also catch him on Twitter
at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
You've been listening to International Edition. Check us out at voanews.com, on Twitter at @VOA_IE, VOA Now on Facebook. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Susan Markham, Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment for the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, wrapped up a five-day visit to Lao PDR in October, during which she met Lao education officials and visited schools to pave the way for the expansion of the U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative to Laos, which President Barack Obama announced during his visit to the country in September. Following a meeting with the Minister of Education and Sports, Senjuan Lachantabun, and senior education officials in Vientiane on October 4th, Ms. Markham and her delegation traveled to Luang Prabang and Udomche provinces, where she discussed education and learning needs with teachers, administrators, students, and parents. We are thrilled to have this opportunity to engage with Lao officials, teachers, parents, and students to learn more about education in this beautiful country, Ms. Markham said. Through the Let Girls Learn initiative, we can find new ways to collaborate and help ensure that adolescent girls and boys get the education they need to be successful. On October 7th, Ms. Markham met representatives of the Lao Women's Union, Lao National Commission for Mothers and Children, the Lao National Commission for the Advancement of Women's Secretariat, and other donors and civil society groups focused on women and development to further understand the needs of girls and women across Laos. The U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative, championed by First Lady Michelle Obama, works to address the range of challenges preventing adolescent girls from attaining a quality education. Let Girls Learn harnesses existing programs and invests in new efforts to improve educational opportunities for girls worldwide. The United States is proud to work with Laos to help Lao girls develop their full potential for their benefit and for the benefit of their communities and the people of Laos.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.